We refuse to stand by in a city where a 7-year-old can't walk from his home to his school without fear of death. Echoing Sean Connery's character in The Untouchables, who promised to take down Al Capone the Chicago way, the mayor said he would do what was necessary to eliminate the gangs in areas like Cabrini Green. "We have to have a war here, and we have to go after them the same way they go after innocent people." At the funeral service, 4 days after his death, Dantrell Davis was outfitted in a white tuxedo with a powder blue cummerbund, a bow tie, and a white leather cap that covered the damage to his head. The pastor described Danny as a warrior, a little David toiling in a community assailed by Goliaths. A soloist sang the lament that ends the Cabrini Green movie, Cooley High. "It's so hard to say goodbye to yesterday." People heard the song and crumpled. At the cemetery, Annette Freeman kissed a red carnation and tossed it onto her son's casket. As the coffin descended into the ground, she yelled that Danny had been the only one left who loved her. Annette's mother, Janice Freeman, had moved to Cabrini Green for safety. She was escaping an uncle who had tried to kill her, a different uncle than Jerome Freeman, known as King Shorty. He was the leader of the Black Disciples, a Chicago gang with thousands of members. He'd joined the gang as a boy, running errands for its founder, David Barksdale. When Barksdale created the Black Gangster Disciples Nation, he became King David, and his folks' alliance adopted as its emblem the 6-point star, the Star of David. The People Alliance used the 5-point star as its symbol. During a Blackstone Rangers ambush in 1970, Barksdale was shot in the abdomen. He survived, but the complications persisted, and 4 years later he died of kidney failure. The Disciples Nation died along with him. Shorty Freeman took over the Black Disciples, and Larry Hoover the Gangster Disciples. At the time of his grandnephew's murder, Shorty Freeman was 2 years into a 28-year sentence for drug trafficking. Hoover and Jeff Fort, of the Blackstone Rangers, were also serving long sentences in prison, all three leaders reportedly running their street operations from behind bars. At Stateville, Freeman held regular meetings in the prison chapel, and Annette was driven to the penitentiary to talk to him about Dantrell's accused killer, Anthony Garrett. In a recorded confession, Garrett admitted to standing on a bathtub in an empty apartment in 1157 North Cleveland and firing an AR-15 rifle at a group of teenagers outside Annette's building. The weapon lacked a scope, and he'd missed his target and struck Dantrell by mistake. The next day, Garrett claimed he was innocent and that the confession had been coerced. He said he'd been held in isolation for 5 hours and beaten until he agreed to whatever police told him to say. Not an implausible charge in Chicago. Revelations were emerging then about a police unit under Commander John Burge that had tortured more than 100 black suspects over the previous 20 years, beating them with phone books, suffocating them, and shocking them with electrical devices on their genitals and in their rectums. Garrett was known around Cabrini Green as Quabine. A former Army Specialist 4th Class trained in marksmanship, he'd racked up 9 convictions from the time he was 18, 6 of them weapons-related. In 1981, on the same day that Mayor Byrne announced her plans to move to Cabrini Green, he'd been arrested for killing another resident in a high-rise stairwell. Although he would be found not guilty of the crime, police said he admitted to the shooting and bragged about being a Cobra Stone leader in charge of multiple buildings. Months before Dantrell was killed, during one of Vince Lane's door-to-door sweeps, police discovered a loaded gun in his Cabrini Green apartment. A judge later ruled that officers illegally seized the weapon, since the CHA raids violated all sorts of protections from unlawful searches, and Garrett was released. Like many people at Cabrini Green, Garrett wasn't just one thing. He umpired baseball games at the housing development, volunteering for free for 3 years until he was able to earn $8 an hour for his time. He was Dantrell Davis's little league coach, and Annette knew him. "He used to like on me and everything, but I wasn't leaving Danny's daddy," she would say. "I was very loyal." Garrett makes an appearance in Daniel Coyle's Hardball, a book documenting a Little League season at Cabrini Green over the months before Dantrell's murder. Coyle writes that Garrett was the best umpire the team saw. A muscular man with a coal black biblical beard. He approached the game with extreme seriousness, bellowing "ball" and "strike" with an undisputed authority. "I like working with kids," Garrett tells the coaches. "I ain't always been straight in my life, but if I can keep a few of them out of trouble, then I done my job." One of the league's corporate sponsors was so impressed by Garrett that he helped him land a maintenance job a short walk from Cabrini at the posh East Bank Club. A membership to East Bank Club is an invitation to live well. The rifle that killed Dantrell was never found, and some police officers at Cabrini assumed Garrett was the fall guy for a heater case that needed an immediate culprit. But neither Annette nor Shorty Freeman were concerned with whether Garrett was innocent or guilty. They both figured that Quabeen killed Dantrell by accident. Plus, Annette was insane with grief, and Shorty knew people were waiting to see his reaction. The moment required that he be a big man. Because Dantrell was kin, his murder had the potential to set off a series of deadly reprisals. No one wanted that. Not unlike Mayor Daley or Vince Lane, the gang leaders needed to demonstrate that they could impose order on a city that more frequently seemed without any. Organized crime was one thing. Disorganized crime, something else entirely. Shorty let it be known among his associates that there would be no revenge. Too many people were already getting hurt under his name. But when Garrett began his 100-year sentence in a Stateville cell house where Shorty called the shots, he didn't stop guys from delivering some private retribution. Exactly a week after Davis's shooting, also just after 9 a.m., hundreds of Chicago police officers and city officials rolled into Cabrini Green, joined by officers from the CHA Security Force, the Cook County Sheriff's Department, the DEA, ATF, and FBI. The police brought in their blue militarized mobile command vehicle, planting it in front of the red high-rises. Platoons of armed officers went floor to floor in two of the high-rises, searching every room in every apartment. Another 100 recruits from the police academy joined the sweeps. Men and teenage boys were flushed from the buildings and searched repeatedly. One resident who joined a lawsuit against the CHA complained that he was searched 7 times in 1 hour, and not just pat-downs, but police going inside his underwear. His 2-year-old son was frisked. The officers turned up just one firearm, a .45 caliber replica of a gun, unable to fire ammunition. In addition to the show of force, Mayor Daley sent in 100 street and sanitation workers. They put in floodlights, laid out poison traps for rats, filled potholes, and scoured the project for abandoned cars to tow. Workers applied fresh coats of paint to graffiti-covered walls. Trimmers lopped off branches, and electricians repaired wires. Carpenters nailed plywood over vacant units that had remained accessible for years. 30 men who had struck deals with the county to exchange jail time for community service cleared the grounds of trash and weeds. Teams installed metal detectors and guard posts, while crews of counselors from the city's Department of Human Services met with residents who'd been forced from their homes. Reporters were allowed to embed with roving teams of social workers, clergy, CHA officials, and armed policemen. Ethan McKaylee, the publisher of Residents' Journal, a newspaper by and for public housing tenants, was then a Cub reporter with the Defender, and joined one of these tours. The sense was of an emergency relief force showing up in a disaster zone. "We're the government," We're here to help you. At one high-rise apartment, a well-dressed young woman who answered the knocking was asked if she needed any assistance. She was confused. With what? Staring at the crowd outside her door, however, she couldn't help but mind her manners. Would they like to come in? McKaylee said the reporters, eager to experience an actual Cabrini-Green public housing unit, crammed into the woman's home. But they were disappointed. The living room and kitchen were simple but clean. A shag carpet covered the floor, and long white curtains decorated the windows. A neatly attired toddler stared up at them in wonder. When McKaylee lingered later on one of the ramps, surprised by the vista of downtown, someone from the CHA ran up to him, breathless. "I thought we'd lost you," she cried. Residents of Cabrini Green had been pleading for regular maintenance, for new light bulbs in the stairwells and roach fumigation and elevator repairs. In the name of Dantrell Davis, all the stored-up service had finally arrived at once, like something out of a fable. With the truckloads of heavy equipment, the workmen bustling about, and the sounds of the chainsaws and welders, it was as if a Hollywood crew were creating the set of an imaginary public housing project from scratch. It also seemed like a bizarre reenactment of events from 1970 and from 1981, after the killings of Severin and Rosado and the arrival of Mayor Byrne. The city's entire apparatus appeared to be focused again on a 70-acre patch of the near north side, home to only 8% of the CHA's population. There were miles of land on the west side that still hadn't been rebuilt since the fires in 1968. At the Henry Horner homes, half of the 1,800 units were vacant, up from just 2% only a decade before, as the CHA wasn't bothering to repair or refill empty apartments. Seven other public housing developments in the city had rates of violent crime that exceeded Cabrini's, and the neighborhood, including the Robert Taylor homes and Stateway Gardens, had the highest proportion of murders in Chicago. They're putting a lot of manpower in Cabrini now, but other neighborhoods need the help as well, a bewildered West Side alderman complained. And what happens after it's not front page news? In the midst of this blitz, Mr. T dropped by Cabrini Green with his signature mohawk, feather earring, and bib of gold chains. The A-team star stepped out of a Rolls Royce, telling children that a car like that could be theirs if they studied hard enough. It was just 2 weeks before the 1992 presidential election, and Bill Clinton stumped at Daley Plaza downtown, asking supporters to help him oust President Bush, who he said would never pay for the additional cops needed to keep Chicago safe. "We owe it to Dantrell Davis," Clinton shouted to cheers. One of the more elaborate dedications to Dantrell Davis was an architectural contest held by the Chicago Tribune. The newspaper put out a call for designs of a safe, livable Cabrini Green. It was an idea contest. The winner would not be hired to design anything, but the hope was that the results would offer a template for the actual remaking of the near North Side development. "Bricks and mortar didn't kill Dantrell Davis," wrote Blair Kamen, the paper's architecture critic. But Kamen did blame the avant-garde modernism of Tower in the Park public housing for its part in turning Cabrini Green into an island of poverty. "Apartheid American style," Kamen wrote, adding that these designs imposed an ideological straitjacket on the free-flowing fabric of big city life. One of the 300 entrants in the competition was a second-generation architect named Mark Amstatter, the son of Lawrence Amstatter, the original architect of the Cabrini Extension Towers. The young Amstatter said that his father's work was held up as the embodiment of an ill-conceived, faulty design. He wanted to win the contest to liberate himself and his father from the trauma of this past. Another entrant proposed outfitting Cabrini with an amusement park, the Big Hell Ferris Wheel. Someone else envisioned a medieval village with dramatic spires topping the high-rises. Yet another suggested connecting Cabrini to the tidal currents of Lake Michigan. But the winners all adhere to the new urbanism that was then coming into fashion, taking their cues from old-school town planning and the anti-modernism prescribed by Jane Jacobs. The winning team, a group from Fargo, North Dakota, of all places, drew up a traditional small-scale cityscape, reattached to the street grid, of low-rise row homes built around a neighborhood square and included commercial buildings, several schools, churches, and a daycare center. It would be an area no longer set at a remove or distinguishable from its surroundings. A half-century later, it demonstrated a return to the country's first model for public housing, the Cabrini Row Houses Redux. In the past, demands to knock down Cabrini Green and the rest of Chicago's high-rise public housing elicited charges of racism or shrugs of helplessness. Almost 100,000 poor black residents lived in the city's public housing, with an additional 44,000 on the CHA waiting list and 70,000 homeless. Where were public housing residents supposed to go? In the most racially divided city in America, however, Dantrell Davis created a bit of consensus. "Now is the time to start tearing down the Chicago Housing Authority high-rises," declared an editorial in the Tribune. Now, while the memory of Dantrell Davis, shot dead at Cabrini Green on his way to grade school, still burns in our civic memory. Like Ayn Rand's protagonist in The Fountainhead, those who formerly supported government housing for the poor were ready to fill the towers with TNT and be done with them. In a survey conducted by The Defender, 2/3 of the respondents thought Cabrini Green should be demolished. The city's newspapers opened up hotlines for callers to suggest solutions. Vince Lane looked to expand an experiment along the lakefront on the south side, in which CHA towers had been rehabbed and filled with a 50-50 mix of public housing and market-rate units. "If we can take Cabrini and turn it around without wholesale displacement of the people who live there, I think that can be a blueprint for this whole country," he announced. Gary Becker, the University of Chicago Nobel Prize-winning economist, suggested that Cabrini privatize, with the government selling the apartments to their current occupants. The CHA floated the idea of buying single-family homes in the suburbs and moving residents there. Cabrini Green did in fact need to be made safer and more livable, and maybe even replaced entirely with something better. But acting out of fear, spurred on by a moral panic, almost guaranteed that those who lived there would lose out with whatever succeeded it. Looking beyond the Dantrell Davis memorials to see the underlying problems that caused the current conditions in the city's public housing, the segregated site placement and overabundance of children, the mismanagement and poor maintenance, the deficits and declining fortunes of cities, the loss of nearby jobs and the departure of working families, the gangs and drugs and the stigma. Seeing any of that had become nearly impossible. Fewer and fewer Americans believed they had a collective responsibility to provide enough for those who had too little. Most serious debate about inner cities, social services, and housing subsidies gave way to tough talk of police, prisons, and demolition. The mayor of suburban Bolingbrook let it be known, just in case, that his village of 40,000 would be accepting 0 families from Cabrini Green. The December after Dantrell's death, word spread at Schiller Elementary that there wouldn't be enough donated Christmas gifts for all 325 eighth graders. In their desperation, some parents began to hoard the remaining presents. With the name Cabrini Green attached, the Grinch parents became national news, a story of public housing dwellers so debased that they would steal Christmas itself. One of the television news anchors reported sorrowfully, "Not even the season of giving could protect the needy from the greedy at Cabrini Green, one of the poorest and meanest of housing projects." Several months earlier, around Easter of that year, Marion Stamps awoke from a dream. The Cabrini Green activist looked at the clock, 4 a.m. and then she began writing out the letter that had appeared to her in her sleep. She was not a churchly person. She didn't spend her Sundays in the pews. Her profane outbursts could startle even the gang members she worked with. But she did consider herself spiritual. "The Lord was revealing to me what he wanted me to do," she said of the dream. That entailed hosting a 4-day feast for the Cabrini Green community, a unity festival, breaking bread with the street organizations, which is how she referred to the gangs. The letter she copied out was a plea not just to them, but also to everyone at Cabrini Green. All bore some guilt for allowing the damage to their community, herself included, even if only by resigning themselves to the appalling normalcy of gun battles and the inevitability of their collateral damage. The letter first addressed the men. "You say you sell drugs because you can't get a job. You brothers will do anything but stand up and be the brave black men you were born to be." Then she called out the women. "You should be sick and tired of being sick and tired. Sisters in the ghettos, trenches, valleys, or whatever you want to call where you live and raise your children, get raped every day for real." In a Cabrini Green divided by gang boundaries, Stamps's Tranquility Marksman was directly across the street from the two Cobra Stones control towers and alongside white high-rises overseen by the gangster disciples. She insisted that her community center be a safe haven, and she regarded herself as a leader of all Cabrini Green, as well as someone who fought for the rights of poor black people throughout Chicago and the world. She signed the letter Queen Nzinga, after the 17th century Angolan monarch who defeated the Portuguese in battle. Stamps was 47 in 1992, and had lived in the area for almost 30 years. That August, a week after the murder of Laquanda Edwards, she joined Cabrini residents as they marched from their home to City Hall. "The residents are entitled to protection and security as United States citizens," a coalition of Cabrini Green tenants wrote in a statement they delivered to the mayor's office. The group pointed out that guns and drugs were transported easily through the development, that police didn't patrol the buildings, and that vacant apartments and abandoned floors were never sealed off. "The citizens of Cabrini Green have exhausted all options at their disposal regarding this frightening situation and have come to you for effective leadership and firm action." In September, Stamps hosted her annual Labor Day block party in front of her center, an event that she held for 22 consecutive years. It included games for children, burgers, ice cream, and music. Stamps talked about her letter and the need for residents to take responsibility for ending the violence. At the fields across the street, the J.P. Morgan Ewes defeated the first Chicago Near North Kikuyus to win the Cabrini Green Little League Championship. Then, a month later, Dantrell Davis was killed. It was a tragedy that could hardly be called a surprise, and Stamps was less shocked than enraged. She was someone who normally used her tirades strategically. She fired off broadsides to disrupt meetings, or attract the media, or to announce that she would not be bullied, not by the Dailies, or Charles Swibel, or Jane Byrne, or anyone. But there was nothing tactical in her fury now. She didn't know Dantrell Davis. She'd never spoken to his mother. But his killing shattered her all the same. Weeping and cursing, she made her way across Division Street, over to 500 West Oak. She needed to see the boy's family, share in the heaviness of the loss. On her way there, she passed gang members outside their buildings, telling them she was serving notice. "Not another motherfucking baby is going to die," she barked. "Since y'all can't figure it out, I am." "What, Marion Stamps, what?" "Enough is a motherfucking enough." She sent word that she wanted to talk to the heads of the gangs. She told them to come to Tranquility. The next week, just after Mayor Daley declared war on the criminal element of Cabrini Green, Stamps held a press conference of her own at a little missionary Baptist church beside the Marshall Field Garden Apartments. Daley had an 11-point Cabrini plan. She presented a 15-point peace plan for Cabrini. Rather than boarding up the high-rise where the rifle cartridge was found, she wanted the building repurposed to house an alternative high school, a library, a youth shelter, and a drug treatment facility. She demanded that empty apartments and other high-rises be repaired, and that families who needed homes be moved into them. She asked that the local schools be fully staffed, and the neighborhood stocked with a food co-op, a movie theater, a bowling alley, and an arcade. Most communities took these sorts of amenities for granted. At Cabrini Green, their addition could mean the difference between life and death. Stamps pressed her first point most of all, calling on street organizations at Cabrini to cease all negative activities, to declare a citywide truce. Tell the black community you are sorry for all this pain and destruction you have caused us. Months earlier in Los Angeles, after the riots following the verdicts in the Rodney King beating, warring gangs had honored a ceasefire. If the Bloods and Crips could pull it off in Watts and South Central, then why couldn't guys from Cabrini Green and all over Chicago do the same? Stamps was ready to ensure that a truce stuck. "Before I let anybody break the peace on this near north side, they'll have to shoot me down like a dog in the street. 'Cause I'm coming at 'em. I'm coming at them. You're not going to do it." When Wallace Gator Bradley heard about these calls for a ceasefire, he believed he was the one who could sell the idea on the streets. A Southsider who seldom traveled to Cabrini Green, Gator knew of Marion Stamps through her activism and admired the way she refused to back down, especially to men. "She was like a present-day Harriet Tubman," he would say. A former enforcer with the Gangster Disciples, Gator saw himself as a diplomat for peace as well. He'd grown up with Larry Hoover on the South Side, and they served time together at Stateville in the 1970s. After his release, Gator founded a public relations firm, Legata Productions, and he worked as an aide to Cook County Commissioner Jerry Iceman Butler, the crooner from Cabrini Green who'd gone into politics. In 1989, Illinois Governor James Thompson, a Republican, granted Bradley a pardon, wiping clean his record, citing his work with children, and Gator ran for alderman of the ward that included the Robert Taylor homes, losing in a runoff to the incumbent. He also continued to act as a spokesperson for Hoover, who was now leading the gang from a minimum security prison 6 hours south of Chicago. In the summer of 1992, Gator was visiting the Temple Mount in Jerusalem's Old City when he experienced an epiphany. Staring at the Wailing Wall, thinking about the divisions between Jews and Arabs, those who identified with the six-point star and those who followed the star and crescent, Gator could suddenly see how little separated the black gangs back home. Whether you were folks or people, you spoke the same language, shared the same culture, were descended from Africans and Southerners. Upon his return to Chicago, Gator started showing guys how the 5-point star and the 6-point star could be combined into a 10-point star by virtue of adding a single letter, the letter L, for love. It was hokey, but people were killing one another over these minute distinctions. Gator needed to demonstrate that these symbols were arbitrary and mutable, that new collective identities could be formed this easily. He printed up white buttons with an image of two clasping hands surrounded by the logos of the city's major black gangs and the words, "United in Peace." In response to Marion Stamps's proclamation, Hoover decreed that there would be a truce. Shorty Freeman did the same, as did the heads of the other black gangs. In their different sections of the city, Gator and Stamps and others spread the news of the peace from street corner to street corner. Any rank-and-file member who didn't honor it would be violated by his own crew. Someone who broke the treaty and was incarcerated would have to answer for his crimes behind the prison walls. Gator told young gangster disciples that he didn't want them or their mothers coming to him after the fact, begging him for another chance. there would be nothing he could do for them. At the end of October, 3 weeks after Dantrell Davis's killing, an actual treaty was signed at a ceremony held at Tranquility Marksman. The leaders of each gang, every nation, showed up with an entourage of 20 or 30 people, filling the great hall in the back of the center. The gang chiefs brought along not only their generals, but also their mothers and grandmothers, their wives, girlfriends, and children. Cousins who were in opposing gangs embraced for the first time in years. Al-Jami Mustafa, the leader of the Mickey Cobras, read from a 5-page document challenging those assembled to prove that they were descendants not of Al Capone, but of great black kings. Although Stamps hosted the event, she spoke little that day. What she asked was that people think of Dantrell Davis and all the other children who'd lost their lives to the violence. At Cabrini Green, no shootings occurred in November. Zero in December. 2 days before Christmas, a 19-year-old walking with his girlfriend on Larrabee was jumped by 5 guys and beaten with bats. The crime was notable for being the first serious assault reported in 2 months. For 8 months, Cabrini Green saw just one shooting and no homicides. Citywide, the year-to-year homicides dipped slightly. The truce included only the black gangs, and it didn't address intra-gang violence or incidents that had nothing to do with gangs. Police reported 570 major crimes, including 2 murders, at Cabrini Green in 1993, compared with 717 major crimes and 7 murders the previous year. Wanting credit for their work, Gator and others sought a meeting with the mayor, but Daley dismissed the treaty as a ruse. "They sell drugs. That's not a gang truce. They sell weapons. They extort money from merchants. They threaten people. Forget about it." Why, then, were there fewer murders at Cabrini Green? Simply put, Daley said, the heat was on. The police had Cabrini on lockdown. In the Tribune, the columnist Mike Royko lampooned the idea that gangs should be commended, saying it had also been a long time since he'd shot anyone, and there were no parades in his honor. Gang leaders and their social activist mouthpieces apparently believe that because they haven't killed each other for a month, they deserve special recognition, Royko wrote. Most Chicagoans endure years, decades, entire lifetimes without shooting another human being. Imagine their frustration. The average bungalow owner in this town never kills anybody. Eric Davis, the police officer known as 21, said that publicly, police officials couldn't praise the gangs. But privately, his superiors instructed him and James Martin, Officer Eddie Murphy, to keep the gang truce in place as long as possible. Children were jumping rope and riding bicycles in Cabrini Green playgrounds. Students were walking to stores without scanning the upper floors of buildings for snipers. Davis and Martin helped start a baseball little league, with teams from the different CHA housing projects competing against one another. No way that could have taken place before the treaty. Years later, after he'd retired from the police force, Davis would admonish himself for squandering an opportunity to change Cabrini Green in a more lasting way. They could have used the relative calm as a lure to bring in employers, job training, drug programs, GED classes. "Was it a good try?" 21 said. "Yeah, but so what? We didn't sustain it. Ultimately, it failed." Gator helped form a national peace movement with the Reverend Jesse Jackson, the Nation of Islam's Louis Farrakhan, and the head of the NAACP joining him and hundreds of other current and former gang members at summits across the country. They met in Kansas City, Cleveland, D.C., Minneapolis, and back in Chicago, insisting that the country couldn't arrest and imprison its way out of a crisis of youth violence. In January 1994, a day before Bill Clinton delivered his second State of the Union address. Gator Bradley and Jesse Jackson drove a white Cadillac to the White House to advise the president on the pressing issue of urban violence. It's unclear what the president took away from the meeting. Later that same year, Clinton signed into law the most sweeping crime bill in the nation's history, greatly accelerating what was already a 20-year trend toward mass incarceration. The crime bill funded the construction of new prisons, enshrined a raft of additional mandatory minimum sentences, and eliminated many prison education programs. The following year, federal officers in Chicago charged 39 members of the Gangster Disciples with conspiracy. Larry Hoover, charged as well after agents recorded him conducting business from prison, would be transferred to the Supermax facility in Florence, Colorado, where he joined Jeff Fort, the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, the 1993 World Trade Center bomber, Ramzi Youssef, and a short list of other high-profile terrorists and organized crime bosses. All of those arrested in Chicago were reputed disciples leaders. But with them gone, the police didn't so much rid the city of the gang as eliminate its top-down authority. Chicago gangs splintered into hundreds of cliques, smaller subgroups that warred with one another. At one of the national peace summits he led, Gator blessed the convocation, praying for the nonviolent movement to prosper before turning to the topic of his detractors. "Father, I ask of you that all those naysayers, all those agents provocateurs, all those who will stand in the way of this peace, I ask that you blind them, snap the limbs in their bodies, and wipe them from the face of the earth. Amen." In the months and years that followed her son's death, Annette Freeman alternated between thoughts of retaliation and of the stupefying fact that Danny was gone and she failed to protect him. She blamed everyone, though most of all, herself. Why hadn't she listened to him the night before when he talked about his fears of dying? Why hadn't she eased up just that once and let him stay home from school? On the 13th of every month, she had a death wish. The only man she ever loved died September 13th. Then her son, the only child she ever had, died the same day a month later. She carried a gun with her, ready to shoot. She'd see a stranger and think, "You want this? Let me show you how much hate and pain I got inside me. I can crush you." Bert Nateras, the alderman of the area that included Cabrini Green, had clipped many of the newspaper stories about Dantrell Davis. He sent them in a carefully arranged packet to Annette. "I write to let you know that we in government have not, or will we ever, forget your son, Dantrell. He helped pass a resolution in the city council to rename a stretch of Cleveland Avenue outside Jenner School, just feet from the shooting, Dantrell Davis Way. Annette didn't know about the dedication ceremony. She heard about the street sign only after a friend saw it at Cabrini Green and phoned her. She was later given a replica of the Dantrell Davis Way sign. But she stored it in a car she was living out of. And when the car was towed, she lost it and her other belongings. People told Annette they would help her with a job, an apartment, a book about Dantrell's life. She never saw any of it. And no one ever suggested counseling. No one helped cool her overheated mind. At one point, she was arrested on a weapons charge and served a year in prison. She needed a gun, she felt, since no one else was out there protecting her. In prison, though, she was able to reflect on her purpose in life. She knew she could take the easy way out and become a drug addict, a killer, a prostitute. She could go and commit suicide because she'd lost everything. But she needed to represent her son in a better way. She didn't want to bring down his name. She was the mother of Dantrell Davis. She would do better. Annette sometimes visited Danny's street sign at Cabrini. She liked that 60 years from now, or in 160 years, no matter how much the neighborhood changed, someone walking over there would look up and say, "Hey, we're on Dantrell Davis Way." She came to believe that his death had happened for a reason. That was why he had smiled at her that morning and said he was doing something. Everything led up to that moment. He was sacrificing his life for others. A citywide truce lasted for 2 years. Many young people who might have been killed were spared. The gangs kept it going because of Danny. And if God gave his only begotten son, who was she to ask questions? That was her comfort. She had to look at it that way. He died to save others. Dantrell Davis changed Chicago forever. Part 3. Rotations on the land. 12. Cabrini mustard and turnip greens. Dolores Wilson. Vince Lane showed up at Dolores Wilson's church in February 1993 to talk about the impending demolition at Cabrini Green. He said change was coming. Dantrell Davis's death, 4 months earlier, guaranteed it. High rises were going to be torn down. 2 of the 23 towers had already been cleared of tenants and boarded up. The world of gangs and drugs had to go. 40 residents had come to hear him at Holy Family, and Lane wanted them to understand that all the attention from Dantrell's murder also meant there were tens of millions of federal dollars available to rebuild. Lane asked the tenants to partner with him in making the new Cabrini Green. He promised that nothing would be done without their input and approval. To give a sense of what a revamped Cabrini might look like, Lane pointed to what he'd done at Lake Park Place, a public housing development on the south side. 4 of the 6 high-rises along the lakefront were vacated and eventually demolished. In the 2 rehabbed towers, only half of the apartments were designated as public housing. The rest were rented at slightly subsidized rates to working-class and middle-class families. When the 2 15-story buildings reopened in 1991, all 282 apartments were filled, with public housing recipients and better-off renters living next to each other on every floor. The rehab resulted in a net loss of more than 550 units of public housing. But Lake Park Place was now livable, Lane explained. You had people of varying incomes who wanted to live there. High-rises weren't the problem at Cabrini Green, he said. Rich people all around them lived in high-rise apartment buildings. The problem was the high concentration of poverty. Lane was a visionary. He could see where public housing policy in the country was headed. Only a couple of years earlier, Jack Kemp, the head of HUD under George H.W. Bush, said he refused to be remembered as the Secretary of Demolition. Kemp had founded the federal HOPE Initiative, not to tear down high-rises, but to hand over responsibility for the properties to the people who lived there. HOPE stood originally for Home Ownership and Opportunity for People Everywhere. But over the next decades, HUD would award cities tens of billions of dollars in HOPE 6 grants to knock down their public housing high-rises and replace them with mixed-income developments like Lake Park Place. Demolition became something that local and federal politicians embraced proudly. While public housing was never more than half alive, as Catherine Bauer called it, the aversion to entitlement programs would come to root ever more deeply in the American mainstream. After winning a majority of seats in Congress in 1994, Republicans said they planned to scrap the entire Department of Housing and Urban Development. President Clinton, touting his cuts to the welfare system and proclaiming that the era of big government is over, preemptively reorganized HUD. He promised to infuse market discipline into public housing. A new law mandated that any large public housing development with a vacancy rate of over 10% undergo a test to determine whether a rehab made sense economically. over the 100,000 units across the country that failed, a sixth of them were in Chicago, a total of 18,500 apartments, twice as many as in any other city. At Cabrini, only the row houses passed. Congress then voted to end the requirement that cities add a unit of public housing for every one torn down, ushering in the era of widespread demolition. By 1999, HUD would boast that Hope 6 had eliminated 50,000 units of public housing nationwide. A decade later, the number had doubled. Every city got in on the action. Philadelphia, Atlanta, Baltimore, Newark. But none would knock down as many as Chicago. Mixed-income developments like Lake Park Place, with their blended populations and low densities, could house only a small percentage of those who had lived in the demolished public housing high-rises. But these new developments would also serve the purpose of clearing the slums, replacing the same public housing buildings that were used to clear the slums of a half-century before. The majority of residents leaving public housing were given vouchers to find apartments on their own. The Section 8 program allowed cities to move away from building and operating actual public housing complexes. The government would instead pay private landlords to rent to qualifying families. By 2000, the CHA was calling itself a facilitator of housing opportunities, and its holdings would include 48,000 vouchers and half as many actual public housing units. The rents the government paid to Section 8 landlords in Chicago were based on an average of the city as a whole, meaning too little for a home in a diverse neighborhood with strong schools and low crime. But, it turned out, somewhat more than the asking price of a place in an overwhelmingly black and poor neighborhood. Landlords in these areas saw a profit in a guaranteed government check. And so the solution for high-rise public housing would also recreate some of its same mistakes. Many of the families relocated with vouchers ended up in areas almost as uniformly black and poor as the government housing they left. Vince Lane couldn't know how vehemently Cabrini Green residents would fight to save their tragic home over the next quarter century, or who among them would get to stay on the land in new mixed-income buildings, or what would happen to those who were dispersed. But he knew that the name Cabrini Green was a catalyst for this change to come. He announced as he prepared the $50 million grant application for the first phase of the development's overhaul, "Cabrini symbolizes all that is wrong with public housing." The residents of 1230 North Burling who listened to Lane were unmoved by his mixed-income vision for Cabrini Green. Their building had the same high concentration of poor and black families as the other towers, and yet they were already partners in its restoration. HUD had awarded the 1230 North Burling Resident Management Corporation $6.8 million to oversee a full-scale renovation of the high-rise. They were getting a new roof, new pipes and trash chutes, a new heating system. They were replacing all the windows and rehabbing every apartment. And like anyone renovating a home, Dolores Wilson and the other managers obsessed over the details. They selected colors and styles, changing their minds 10 times before settling on their picks. Blinds, white levelure. Tile, mauve vinyl. Elevator entrance, terracotta. Exterior facade, eggshell. They interviewed engineers, contractors, and suppliers. They devised a 5-phase renovation schedule, with families slated to move temporarily into rehabbed vacant apartments in the building while their own units were completed. Bertha Gilkey warned them that they needed to document how every cent was spent, since people were going to assume that they were incompetent, or worse, thieves. If the renovation was over budget or shoddily done, the residents were sure to be blamed. "I was scared," Dolores would say. "I figured we were going to mess up on this or that." So it was a milestone worthy of jubilation when their Resident Management Corporation finalized its very first construction contract in 1992 for the installation of the weather sealing double pane windows and the repair of the tower's exterior concrete. Dolores wrote in the flyer announcing the celebration, This ceremony would symbolize the success of the RMC's hard work, cooperative spirit, and participation in the comprehensive modernization program. As further proof of how much they'd accomplished, she included in the invite the contract number for the work and its dollar amount, $1,274,000. The general contractor that Dolores helped pick came highly recommended. Shaw Engineering had numerous jobs with the city and state. When the work progressed slower than scheduled, the firm's owner, Manu Shaw, assured her that there were always unforeseen delays. He said his crew had discovered lead-based paint in many of the apartments. The craftspeople he hired complained as well about cockroaches, saying they weren't paid to be exterminators. When Shaw bid on the project, he and his subcontractors had to detail how they would hire residents. People from the building wanted to work. Dolores and her team readied them, sending residents to training sessions, giving them tips on how to be interviewed, and submitting their names to the CHA and HUD. But the contractors and subcontractors came up with excuses for why they didn't hire more people from the lists provided. One morning, when the painters and drywallers showed up for work, a group of residents barred their entrance into the building. The tenants were shutting down the work site until the contract was honored. Days passed, and then weeks. The CHA assigned an official to mediate the dispute. Shaw agreed to another round of interviews. One subcontractor hired 6 additional tenants. The roofer took on 2 residents at $13.57 an hour. Work on the building resumed. A few years later, after a long federal investigation, Manu Shaw pleaded guilty to bilking the city and state out of $10 million. His engineering firm had been awarded more than 60 government contracts with Chicago alone, and it was caught overcharging on the jobs. The residents of 1230 North Burling could only shake their heads. "That's Chicago," they'd say. They'd seen it before. But as far as the renovation of their building went, Dolores and her neighbors were thrilled with the results. Amid the public outcry to tear down Cabrini Green, their high-rise looked new. The outside walls were restored to the color of creamy vanilla. The mechanicals were updated, and Dolores loved her new kitchen and weather-sealing double-pane windows. "Everyone wanted to move into the Burling," she'd say. The building didn't just look good. For the residents, it was a monument to what could be accomplished when they were given the power to shape their own lives. "I wish Oprah had said, 'There are no children here,'" Dolores would pronounce. The Alex Kotlowitz bestseller about the Horner Homes had been made into a television movie starring Oprah Winfrey as the mother of Lafayette and Pharaoh Rivers. "We would have been all over her," Dolores went on. "Children still live here." In the first issue of Voices of Cabrini, in April 1993, the newspaper's co-editor, Mark Pratt, welcomed readers by expounding on the publication's name. "How often have you sat and either watched a report on television or read an article in a newspaper about Cabrini Green and said to yourself, 'I wish they had spoken to me,' because you felt you had something to contribute or debate?" 6 months had passed since Dantrell Davis's murder, and Pratt was sick of the police sweeps and his neighborhood being called out as a paragon of inner-city horrors. He'd been a small child in 1972 when his family moved to the row houses, and he was ready to set the record straight on many things. He wrote of the homegrown gang truce. "It is a well-acknowledged fact by some police officers within the Cabrini community that the peace treaty is really what has changed the safety of Cabrini and not the stormtroopers or Nazi-like tactics of the lockdown." One contributor, addressing the imbalance in the media coverage of his home, wrote, "When something bad does happen in Cabrini Green, and you do a story on it, please leave Dantrell Davis out of it. Let him rest in peace." Every 3 or 4 or 5 weeks, whenever an edition was completed, Voices of Cabrini would be filled with lists of graduates from the local public schools, tutoring programs, and GED classes, updates on the Little League season, and congratulations to tenants like Natalie Howard, of 9-11 North Hudson, who took first place in the playground safety contest. It included poems, movie reviews, and remembrances of those who'd passed. The paper shared tips on how to identify child abuse and how to deal with an infant who wouldn't sleep. Sidebars explained tenants' rights and provided information on the area's churches and legal aid clinics. A lifetime Cabrini tenant, reflecting on his journey into and out of addiction, thanked local role models, notably Hubert Wilson, whose drum and bugle corps had inspired him to get clean and to teach drums at Sojourner Truth Elementary. "A family man," he wrote in memory of Dolores's husband, who still took time to be an outside father to boys who didn't have a father. The newspaper grew out of an unexpected alliance between Cabrini Green and the wealthy North Shore suburb of Winnetka. Peter Benkendorf, who operated a Chicago nonprofit focused on civic engagement, made the match. As he followed the news of Dantrell Davis, he recalled a shooting that had occurred in Winnetka 4 years earlier. A 30-year-old woman named Lori Dan, after trying to poison dozens with arsenic, walked into an elementary school with 3 guns, shooting 6 and killing 1 child before taking her own life. The events led to a book, Murder of Innocence, and a made-for-television movie starring Valerie Bertinelli as the unhinged killer. School shooting wasn't yet a thing, but Benkendorf imagined that Cabrini Green and Winnetka shared an unexplored bond. He connected with Henrietta Thompson, a Cabrini tenant who'd assisted the Candyman producers when they filmed on location at the development. They drove out to Winnetka and met with a group of women who'd started a community newspaper following the Lori Dan incident as a form of therapy and a way to rebuild trust. At Cabrini, no one received grief counseling, not even Dantrell's young classmates, and residents were being told there was little there worth saving. Thompson liked the idea of the newspaper. She and Pratt shared the editing responsibilities. Another 10 Cabrini residents joined the staff, and during the first year of publication, nearly 100 people from Cabrini Green contributed. They laid out the pages at a nearby ad agency where Benkendorf had worked, printing 1,000 copies of each issue. Pratt borrowed a used car to deliver stacks of the papers to the high-rises and row houses, to local churches and community centers. Jimmy Williams, who was a teenager, had been the drummer in the Electric Force Band, wrote a regular advice column, often of the tough love variety.
"Peer pressure? What the hell is that? If you feel so low about yourself that you must follow the Joneses, lay down and die."
Godfrey Bay, who'd grown up in public housing on the West Side and owned a fast food seafood restaurant, wrote a cooking column called "Come and Get It." He presented recipes for such dishes as spaghetti conquistador and Cabrini mustard and turnip greens. The reviewer who covered the music scene at Cabrini Green, Chi-Town's capital hip-hop headquarters, mailed in his pieces from rural Illinois, 4 hours southwest of Chicago. Queso, who'd written lyrics for the Slick Boys, was in a state prison serving 5 years on a drug conviction. He managed to keep up with the trends. He rated Naughty by Nature's Hip Hop Hooray the dopest single of 1993. And what he couldn't verify from the penitentiary, he made up. Born Pete Keller in a section of the near North Side neighboring Cabrini, he renamed himself Queso at 12 for knowledge, strength, opportunity. As a teenager, he decided to make Cabrini Green his home, residing over the years in the row houses and 21 of the 23 high-rises. He loved the public housing project. He hated it, too, since many of the people he knew and cared about there ended up dead, in prison, or strung out, sometimes on the drugs he sold them. "Cabrini Green has layers," he'd say. "Cabrini has so many fucked up multiple layers." In 1995, when Keller was paroled from prison, he hopped a Greyhound back to Chicago and finished out his sentence under house arrest in a Cabrini Green high-rise. Voices of Cabrini had stalled by then, and Queso restarted the paper with the zeal of someone who'd thought about little else for 30 months in an 8-by-10-foot cell. In one of the many articles he wrote, He tried to make sense of a visit to Cabrini Green by U.S. Congressman Christopher Shays, a Connecticut Republican who showed up at the housing complex unannounced over a Labor Day weekend. Ever since Jane Burns